there, listeners and viewers, and welcome back to episode 2 on Disrupt Ed with two terrific thought leaders who've really engaged on the topic in a provocative way. And that's thought leader from the Clayton Christensen Institute, Michael Horn, and best-selling author, and Jason Aubrey, the current founder and CEO of Skilltrade. Michael, I'm going to kick it off with you because I want to get into this topic that a lot of people are wrestling with, and that is job training for jobs that aren't quite there. You know, I have two sons that enter the workforce as millennials, and both of them started in jobs that didn't exist when they were freshmen in college. And I think we're going to see more and more of that. So, and you talk about that in your latest book. So let's give a plug for the book and hear from you about, you know, what that's starting to look like.
Yeah. Well, look, let's be honest, right? No one knows exactly where it goes. No one's a soothsayer on this. The approach we took in Job Moves, 9 Steps for Making Progress in Your Career, is helping people understand why they're trying to make the move that they are between jobs. And if they understand their actual root causes that's driving them, and they can map that to where do they get energy, what are the things they like doing, focus on the doing more than the being. The being is the title, the money, that stuff. Short-term return to ego, long-term path to unhappiness. If you can really focus on the doing, then what we call these jobs as they emerge and how you find fit can be much more malleable, because what you realize is the skill sets are the things that, you know, really lit you up in one role. It's no longer there, but it actually appears in this new thing, right? As, you know, 20% of the role here, and you take something else you really like doing and sort of match them together. That's where these jobs that are being created do, is that it's not like obliterating things that we like to do completely. We may have to learn new skills to be able to do them. But if you can really focus on the doing, the verb, if you will, and start to find match as these new things emerge in the day-to-day and week-to-week of those jobs, that's how you can sort of navigate that. I will tell you the other secret sauce of this, which is people think job switching is solitary. It is not. 50 to 85% of jobs are filled by who you know, by your network. And I think it's actually going to go up more, because right now, young people, when they say, okay, I'm getting a job, I'm going to have the AI agent apply to 1,000 things for me. It's going to tailor my resume for the job description. I'll get through the applicant tracking system. And you know, the hiring manager on the other side is like, I don't believe any of these resumes coming in actually represents what this person can do. I'm just going to call up Ron and be like, hey, do you have someone who can do these things? It's a new role. We've never done it before, but this is the sorts of things someone's going to do. And Ron's like, oh yeah, man, I talked to that guy last week, connect with him, right? And that's how we find jobs. But that's also how we figure out what's coming, is by plugging into our network and understanding what they need.
Well, it's not only, you know, it seems to me it's not only about transferable skills as jobs, you know, become more agile and more adaptive to the needs of the business, but it's also about people understanding that they have agency to direct this activity. You know, so many people are waiting for a job description. They're waiting for their boss to tell them something. I had a management consultant on recently, Brad Fetterman, who talks about this in his practice. And one of the examples he used, I thought, was really illuminating. He had a person in his employ who came to him and said, I don't really like what I'm doing and I'm going to resign. And so he said, well, let's talk about what you want to do and see if we can't map that. And so he showed her, you know, a job, you know, he talked to her about a job description that was open, and she said, you know, I'm not really interested in that. And so he said, okay, then why don't you go off and think about this and come back to me with sort of a framework of what you'd like to be doing and what you want to call it, how you want to name it. And so she came back a week later and she laid things out, and he said, you know, that's really important to our organization. I can see you in that role. Let's do this. And as she left his office, you know, he said out loud to himself, you know, that's the basic job description I gave her a week ago. You know, what really happened was that she developed her own agency about what she wanted to do. And I think that's, you know, that's a telling example of what you're talking about.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, several people, when we profile them in the book, right, like as they figured out what they actually wanted to do, they could articulate that to their boss and they would say, oh, okay, if that's what you want, it's a lot less extreme than resigning or asking to be in the C-suite tomorrow. Or, you know, sometimes these demands sound huge, but when you actually peel it back to what someone really wants to do next, you're like, oh, I can give you a stretch assignment in that area, pull this off your plate and give it to, you know, Jason, who's better at it anyway. And then we'll morph this and let you travel a little bit less. Boom, done, right? And so you realize this may be a little bit different in the healthcare field, Jason, but you realize a lot of job descriptions, they're made up. They're not what people actually do on the job. They're what we sort of invented in our head, and they're much more malleable as a result. And individuals, the question we ask them to really get comfortable is, what are you hiring the job to do for you? You're not just being hired, you are also hiring the job. You have agency in that choice.
Right. That's becoming really important in this very tight labor market. I think, you know, certainly when I came into the job field and there was a recession going on and you really had to be buttoned up to get one of the few jobs that was available, that was important. But now we have a different labor market dynamic going on, and that's where we're all chasing talent out there. Jason, your thoughts about this?
Largely what Michael said. I think, you know, as it relates to job descriptions on the employee side, I think the employer actually owns a lot of that as well. And I'll never forget when I entered the workforce, I was 27, 28 when I got a first time CEO position. And I said to my board, hey, I need to hire a CFO. And they laughed at me because they said, you don't even know what a good CFO looks like. Right. Like, in other words, you haven't been around long enough and you don't know what good looks like. And so the reason I'm saying that the employer owns a lot of it is you better know exactly what you need and be entrenched in an industry so much that you have experience and you actually do know what good looks like. And you can always train someone up. Right. But you have to identify that gap to make that individual successful, because otherwise you're both going to be frustrated. They're going to resign, or unfortunately, you're going to let that person go. And so, I don't know, that's kind of, in addition to what Michael said, I would just add that, you know, a little additional color.
Yeah.
Let's talk about the employer in this, because I've certainly seen the role of employers in workforce training change extraordinarily in the last decade. You know, I was part of a team of people that ushered in what we now call the education as a benefit movement, where corporations with massive workforces of frontline workers finally decided, wait a minute, it's not, you know, it doesn't matter that people are leaving and there's high turnover. What matters is that they're skilled and they leave us better skilled. And so as companies sort of retrenched in that direction, starting with Starbucks with their college program and then McDonald's with Archways to Opportunity, which I had the privilege to work on and help them develop and launch, you know, the companies changed their outlook about education as a benefit. And they said, okay, our system isn't working. It was traditionally limited training for the high pots, the high potential employees, you know, MBA programs and graduate programs. And then all of a sudden they flipped the pyramid. So they were addressing the needs of a large workforce. And whoa, what did they find out? You know, if you look at the 10-year study that McDonald's did on their workforce, it's remarkable. You know, 50% improvement in people's mobility once they completed a program there. You know, they have people, when they started the program, Ron Lauber, the CLO at the time, told me that 40% of the workforce that was brought on new left before their training was over or upon conclusion of their onboarding. That's remarkable. How can you operate a business? And so Rob was very influential, and his partner Lisa Schumacher redesigned their view of education, and they said, okay, we're going to look at you know, what we want from our frontline employees, and we're going to give back also. So they're going to come here, and if they work more than, you know, 60 or 90 days, we're going to make sure that they leave with some human skills of interacting with the public. They're going to have some really great durable skills, and they're also going to have some form of a credential, because they can get their high school diploma if they don't have it. They can get assistance to complete their college, and that's really ushered in a new thing. So what are you seeing from employers in terms of their commitment and investment in what you're talking about and giving people agency over their career development?
Yeah, sure. And then Jason's obviously on the front lines with the health system, so I'd be super curious to hear from him on this as well. Obviously, I was at Guild, so I saw some of this movement up close as well. And it's interesting just to trace the history, right? I think companies were very willing to invest in individuals when they stayed their whole careers at one company. That started to change. People change jobs in the US every 4 years on average, 3.9 at the moment, but who's counting? And the point being, though, people became less loyal. They were constantly switching. And so employers started to pull back, and they said, I don't really want to train this person if they're going to be gone in X number of years, let alone if you're a frontline employee in X number of days. And then I think a couple things happen. One, there's the Richard Branson quote, what if you don't train them and they stay? Then where are you? And then two, right? And then two, people realized, well, gosh, like we're not, like our talent pipeline is sorely lacking in this sort of poaching zero sum game. As baby boomers are leaving the workforce, it does not work anymore. Like it does not add up for us as an individual firm. Like before, we just hoped we were the last one standing, right? It's not working for anyone. It's broken. And so you actually have to invest. And that becomes a point of differentiation to get people in the door in the beginning, stay longer, do a better job with where they are. And if they leave out, they might boomerang back and they have that loyalty again to you. And so it's, I think it's really changed employer conceptions, and they've realized, look, if we're not getting the talent from the station, you know, behind us in the supply chain, higher ed, if you will, we got to integrate backwards and start to fulfill and do those things as well. And frankly, given the pace at which work is changing, to your, you know, to the first question you asked, Ron, an employer knows that best, right? Like the arm's length academic institution that builds programs out of its professors' research is not going to have a bird's eye view into that. And so I actually have to get into the design and shaping with whoever is building the program for me if I hope to have the talent doing what I need to do to deliver on my key performance indicators and actually deliver the outcomes that are expected of me.
Jason, bring the healthcare industry into this conversation for us, if you will, and talk a little bit about, you know, jobs that are being defined as we speak because of the needs in the healthcare system that are not being fully met by the current workforce.
Sure. I mean, first, I would say education as a benefit, I think, is an incredible additional benefit, right? Employers need to do it to stay competitive from a recruitment standpoint. It's no longer just about, hey, we offer health insurance, we offer vision, 401k. And if you're a large organization, say it's McDonald's, Walmart, Chipotle, or Amazon, and let's say your average tenure of a frontline worker was 9 to 12 months, but with education as a benefit, it goes to 18 months, you know, that's obviously positive, right? And of course that they want individuals to upskill and stay, but also you can upskill and leave. And I think that's a really important distinction. So as an example, and I'll segue now into healthcare. I think, like, let's say take a hospital system who's partnered with an education as a benefit platform. I think some have made mistakes because they cascaded the opportunity out without real thought regarding, well, what does this mean for the student? What does this mean for us? Are we solving a critical staffing shortage? So let's say I need 20 surge techs. Okay, well, we're going to offer this upskilling platform or opportunity to select individuals, but who are the right individuals that are perfect for this transition? And I don't think everyone has actually always thought like that. I think they've learned the hard way and they're starting to now. And one thing I would say is I'm really impressed with Amazon as an example. They have education as a benefit. They're doing it on their own, frankly, through Amazon Career Choice. But what they've done is they've actually hired leaders in each discipline. And so we're talking to the program director in healthcare, who comes from a clinical background and a teaching background, and she knows everything, right? As an example, hey, our you know, on average, the individuals that enroll in an upskilling program, they earn about $20 to $22 an hour. And so number one, we don't want them to enroll in any program unless they can earn $25 an hour somewhere else. Okay. But we're really interested in surge tech, but we realize that that's actually really hard for someone to enroll in a surge tech program that's not already working in healthcare. So what we want to do is we want to enroll them in a sterile processing tech program, let them get a job at a hospital. Then they're already in the OR. They're already associated with surgery. And so then they can upskill as a surge tech. And so I think there's kind of these learnings, right, along the way to make this system even more effective and actually yield an ROI for everybody.
Yeah, I think the aha moment for me in what you're describing with Career Choice at Amazon is that companies finally realized they have an obligation to their employees that extends well beyond their employment tenure with the organization. Mm-hmm. I mean, in Amazon creating that program, they tacitly accepted the fact that a lot of the people that they were going to hire were not going to be with them.
Let's be real, or we'll be replaced by AI in a year.
Right.
Well, so stay on that, right? It's a strategic look at this. And I think the mistake, just to double down on Jason's point, when we researched choosing college, we looked at a bunch of individuals, you know, from the 18-year-old to the 60-year-old, frankly, who was making the decision for post-secondary education. And what was interesting about that is that there were a whole host of them that were employed, getting education as a benefit, and completely unengaged in it. And why was that? Because they felt like, oh, this is what's expected of me, but I can't see the value for me. Like, it's, you know, they were like the frontline employee at a retail location who was in a healthcare program learning about the ACA. And they were like, I don't see the connection, guys. Right. And there was none. And so to Jason's point, being much more strategic about opportunity, what does it mean? Right. Individual and matching those. That's when the magic happens. And that's when you get beyond the sort of 2% uptake, right, of education as a benefit, when you're much more strategic across your workforce and across what you're trying to achieve.
You know, the other organization that I've seen and worked with that's done a lot in this area is Starbucks. And I think one of the reasons why they've been successful is they've adapted their program. They started out with low uptake of the college program, but they're working with literally the most innovative higher education institution. And Michael Crow, president of ASU, is by far one of the top innovators in our space today. I mean, he's incredible, and what he's done at ASU has been incredible. But I think, to your point, some of that is now trickling down to others. And, you know, you have someone there that's doing something that's actually working, and it does socialize its way through the ecosystem.
Yeah, and more competition is coming into the space, which, you know, I think always drives efficiency and the right solutions. And I won't name names yet, but it's a potential partnership that we're going to formulate with it's a national university. They're developing a platform for employers to actually identify the right candidates for upskilling. They can then have this career ladder where along the way, whether they start with a certification, associate's, bachelor's, master's degree, the college transfer credit articulates, and it's just this one holistic approach to solving critical staffing shortages across all types of roles in an organization. And I think, you know, frankly, they've probably were inspired by Guild, right? It was kind of really the pioneer in this space, and obviously more competition is coming into it. And I think you're going to see a trend where actually higher education is going to go direct and try and compete in the education as a benefit platform, not only through marketplaces, but through their own capabilities.
Right. I want to put you on the spot a little bit, Jason, you know, because of the organizations that I've had the pleasure of working with, you are one of the top-notch people in understanding the necessity and the requirement now, the strategic requirement to create meaningful public-private partnerships to really solve this. And you've got a secret sauce going. When I look at how young your organization is and how broad the partnership portfolio is, the people you're working with. You know, you've obviously got this going on. Tell us, you know, what's your secret? Partnerships are hard to come by, you know, because you're taking two organizations off their game and they have to step out of that world and try to figure out how to work with someone else. It's oftentimes herding cats, right? So I think that partnership aspect is so important to it. So how are you herding these cats?
Well, like you said, you know, that could be our secret sauce and our competitive advantage. So I'll keep a lot of that close to the chest. But look, to your point, it is herding cats. I think it's, you know, if you're a business leader, irrespective of what market you're in, generally speaking, you have to really know that market. And really, if you think about what is a market, it's a group of people who basically have the same problems. They tend to buy the same solutions and they go into a market. It's just actually like-minded people, but there's so many dynamics within a market. And if you really know that market, I'm not saying it's easy, but it's a lot easier than just stepping into it. And so we know, as an example, how organizations think, how higher education thinks, who do you need to talk to at these organizations? We know the funding flows from the federal government, the state governments. We know the nonprofit organizations that exist. And so having that knowledge is obviously very key. And that took a while to obtain that kind of wherewithal. But it's also who you hire, right? Like, your team is so incredibly important. And that goes back to what I said, I think it was in episode one, regarding, right, if you're an employer, you can't just write a job description. You have to really, really know what you're looking for, and you have to know what good looks like. And so we at Skilltrade, we've been fortunate to, you know, have a top tier talent team, which has certainly, you know, been helping us formulate some of these partnerships even early on in our tenure.
Mm-hmm. Michael, you were going to say something about this.
No, I think he nailed it. I'm good.
As we conclude episode two here, give me your last thoughts and your sort of forecast of where this is heading. You know, where employers and skill providers, trainers, and institutions are kind of coming together to solve this broader issue of a very highly agile, adaptive workplace that's making requirements that are unforeseen.
Yeah, I'll call back to theory on this, right? So there's a theory related to disruptive innovation called interdependence and modularity. And basically what it says is that when the solutions are unpredictable, you can't verify or have clarity in advance, you need to be an interdependent design, meaning that these things need to be tightly coupled and they're not sort of just handoff, you know, buy it in the open market. There's a specification that clearly met, et cetera, to design. And when it becomes predictable and so forth, you move to a modular state. I believe we were in a modular state before, where we basically said to higher ed or other training organizations, throw it over there. We trust you, do your thing. And then you throw it over to us. Good enough. You know, we'll take the talent. We're in a world right now where the pace of change is such that modular arm's length relationship no longer works. And so education and work is more and more interdependent, meaning we need to be working and designing together in tightly coupled ways. I think that means experiential learning from employers, frankly, needs to be stretching back to middle and high school as well at all levels of the education system. And so I think it's a dramatic redesign. It's a dramatic opportunity, but we can't codify curriculum for something changing this quickly in many spaces. That's why it's best to learn in really experiential ways. And the more we see these tightly coupled partnerships, I think the better off everyone will be.
I think that's a really bold insight about how this is all playing out, this idea of modularity. I mean, I think you nailed it right there. Jason, what were you going to say? Last minute thoughts about where this is going?
In my prediction, which I hope comes true, I think you'll see just generally in the industry, more integration with career and technical education in the K-12 system. I think you'll see smarter consumers, prospective students who actually look at debt in the most economical path towards a degree, which I hope they all strive to still obtain, whether it starts with a certification or not. And I actually think that, and I really hope that, all of these types of solutions that we're talking about, whether it's upskilling, cross-training, education as a benefit, career pathways, education pathways, I hope that the local communities start to adopt this. Because in my opinion, right, why did the community college system even exist in the first place? It was because they were in their own markets. They knew what the employer needs were, and that's what they were there for. And I hope that trade schools, community colleges, they become more relevant and they adopt some of these capabilities to support their local workforce and economy.
Gentlemen, this has been a really thought-provoking conversation. I thank you, Michael Horn, and I thank you, Jason, for really mixing it up in these two episodes. My last request is first to our audience. You've been listening to Michael Horn and Jason Aubrey talking about the future-proof workforce, the workforce of the future, and the steps we need to take now in a highly disrupted world to get there. And so get engaged with us. Give us your feedback. Let us know what you think. And bring us your questions so that we can fulfill answers to those as we continue down this path. Thank you both for joining us. And I'm going to welcome you both back over the next couple months to continue this conversation. Thanks so much for joining us. This has been Disrupt Ed. Come back for more.